Good afternoon. We'll do the chancellor's trick one more time. Thank you for your attention. Hope you enjoyed your lunch. Please feel free to continue eating. We do want to get this conversation underway. So I'm going to start by acknowledging, again, I'm Dan from City Club, and it's so great to have such a great diverse group of civic leaders here in the room. And I'd like to start by thanking, of course, Madam President, President Preckwinkle. Our Cook County Board President is here with us. And I believe another elected official, Representative Lisa Davis, is here, UIUC. There we go, UIUC alum. Well, we're on presidents. How about President Tim Killeen from the University of Illinois system? A wonderful speaker here at the City Club. Chancellor Marilyn Miranda, another speaker here at City Club and great partner of ours who we'd love to see. There's another chancellor, Chancellor Janet Gooch, U of I Springfield, is here with us. There's a lot of discussion going on at this table. The chair of the board of the University of Illinois system is also here, Jesse Ruiz, a great civic leader here in Chicago, who we are proud to call a great friend of the City Club. I believe Martin Torres is here, another board member and friend of the City Club. Clerk Anna Valencia, another elected official here. Who will be speaking here at City Club in a couple weeks. Check our calendar. Nick Jones, U of I. Thank you, Nick. We've got a great partnership with this whole system. So you'll see recurring themes here. Beth is here. You know, UIC, U of I, you all are so important to this civic community in Chicago, and we appreciate that at City Club. Adam Miranda is here from Better Up. Where's Adam? I believe Robin Staines is here, another great philanthropic leader. What a great group of people. We actually have a couple of students. I mentioned that Hope Chicago is here as a sponsor. They have a couple special guests. Yes, they brought a couple special guests. Devin Reynolds and Dukara Moody are both, they're both Morgan Park High School Hope Scholars. And they both attend UIUC, so they are the future. Chancellor, you got to make sure you meet them. They are the future, and they're also future civic leaders here in Chicago. We just see how they show up. Devon is a senior majoring in information sciences, has already accepted a job offer. So no more requests for Devon. She's going to work at McDonald's. I don't know if that's breaking news here in Chicago at the headquarters. How cool is that? Dukar is a sophomore education major, so you can maybe offer her a job. She wants to return to Chicago and become a high school math teacher at CPS. How cool is that? We'll make a couple introductions for you. We love having young people in the room. We love having this diversity of leaders in the room. There's so much to get into. We appreciate public service. We appreciate education. We talk about all sorts of issues. We have difficult conversations. So many of you know this might be your third time here this week. We tried to change the menu up a little bit. There are a lot of hard conversations. There's a lot to talk about, and City Club is very, we very much appreciate our position of sharing this platform. Some days it's not things that we want to be talking about. You know, today we're thinking about our friends in Minneapolis. They've been through enough, right? We know a little bit about what that's about in Chicago. And it's, you know, it's not fair. And it's happening in other places, and it's happening a lot of times. You know, next week we have a program with Jens Ludwig on gun violence. There's a common denominator. You know, Salt Lake City last night, Minneapolis, they're guns. These are guns. There are too many guns. Too many guns in Chicago. You know, take political views out of it. People are dying. These are people in our communities. These are students. These are, you know, our future. And we're going to talk more about that. But I wanted to mention that we, of course, as a civic community here, are very thoughtful, and we all are engaged in our own way to make our city and our state better. And we certainly care about those in the other cities who are doing the same. So let's keep those, especially Minneapolis, as they struggle with what's going on today. Thank you for that. We're here today to hear from not me, but one gentleman who I actually listened to this morning on Rufus Williams' show on WVON. Rufus, that was an excellent interview. I'm going to try not to copy your exact, you know, you did such a great job. But I'll just play it. Why don't we just do that? We'll turn the lights down, you know, eat the lemon cookies. But it really is an honor for me to sit. Oh, and Ryan Baker's here. You guys all, you know, thanks for being here. You know how it is to interview and to be, what a great group. It's an honor for me to be able to sit up here and have this conversation in front of you all. Who are doing great things, and I'm going to welcome the chancellor up without too much of an introduction, because we're going to learn all about him. So please, if you would join me in welcoming to the City Club, Charles Lee Isbell Jr., Dr. Charles Lee Isbell Jr., the 11th chancellor of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. You know, it's a big step. Come on, we'll make sure you. We got a taller stage. I don't know why. Welcome.
Thank you.
I know you're no stranger to Chicago, but I believe it's your first time at City Club.
Yes.
Is it? Welcome. You're very welcome here, and we hope that you'll come back already.
Absolutely.
Let's Great start food. With today. Great food?
Mm-hmm.
I think we're here on Tuesday and Wednesday if you'd like to come back. But we know you're busy. You've been busy. You started in August.
Yes, officially.
How'd you get here? Can we just reverse a bit, and then we could talk about what's going on at the university and maybe some of what you hope to be accomplishing. But could we start by just talking a little bit about how you got here, who you are? This is, you know, so many of these folks from the university system, but this is Chicago's civic community, mm-hmm. and they want to know you, where you came from, what drives you. How'd you get here? And I don't mean like, well, you could talk about it if you got on a bus or a train, or, but how'd you get here to this City Club stage in this position as the chancellor, the 11th chancellor of the University of Illinois system?
I appreciate the question.
Or, Illinois, I'm sorry, Champaign-Urbana.
Yeah, that's okay. Sorry, Tim. So, first off, good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, everyone. There you go. That's the energy I like. Very much looking forward to this conversation and a conversation with all of you both now and in the future. I appreciate the question of how did I get here? I think it's a really important one, because it explains so much about any answers that I will give to any questions that you have. I think it's always important for people to be clear about what motivates them, why they do the things that they do. So there's kind of two answers. There's one is the biography. So as you can tell by my accent, I was born in Chattanooga, Tennessee. My earliest memory is arriving in Atlanta in a moving truck at the age of 3 1/2. So I think of myself as being from Atlanta. I am a Southern boy. I lived down the street where there were two Waffle Houses on different sides of the street, because you didn't want to have to make a left turn in the Waffle House. So they were directly across the street, and they both did great business, right? That's where I grew up. That's where I lived. I went to all public schools. Ended up at Georgia Tech. It was my alma mater as an undergrad. We'll point out that is the only school that I applied to, because I didn't know any better. I was just told that this was a great school, which is true, and that it did what I was interested in doing, and so I could apply. And so I did, and I got there. Georgia Tech is in the center of Midtown Atlanta. Kind of important to know that if you, this is what they told us when we arrived. If you had a 1 megaton nuclear bomb, and you wanted to do the, yes, that's exactly what I said. And you wanted to do maximum damage to the city of Atlanta, you would drop it right here in the center of Georgia Tech. And I was like, great. Okay. So I was right there in the center of my city. I grew up 8 miles away from there. Might as well have been 800 miles. It was a wonderful university, remains a wonderful university. I have nothing but positive things to say about my alma mater. But it was another world. It was a different place. I'm growing up in Atlanta, people who know about the history of Atlanta, center of the Civil Rights Movement, a place where so many things happened in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and before and since. And yet this was a completely different world. My first day on campus, I remember walking across and not seeing anyone who looked like me as much as and I loved that place and learned a lot there. But it told me a lot about how easy it is to be in the bubble of where you are and not recognize what else is going on in the world. So I learned a lot from that experience. Went on to a small university in Boston, did grad school, spent 4 years at Bell Labs working on
small industrial research. Back up a minute. Which one is that?
MIT.
Right. The short name, yeah. Okay.
Very short. It was a wonderful place. It was Boston. I'm not having a conversation about Boston, but it was a nice, cold place to live for a while. And I ended up back in Atlanta, where I spent my time doing computer science research, AI, machine learning. I did a lot of teaching. The thing, if you want to know about me, about sort of my history and how I ended up here, is there's two stories. One's about Illinois. The other is about my career at Tech. The one at Tech is the day I became an associate professor with tenure. So 6 years in, you go up for tenure, you're up or out, is what happens. And I got promoted to associate professor. It was the day I became an associate dean for undergraduate education. So, which I don't recommend. That's crazy what I did, but it worked out that there's a world where you think about your research and your teaching, and you think about the enterprise of education, higher education as an individual, but there's also this kind of knowledge and thinking about what is the university, why is it, how do you serve the people who are a part of it and the people who aren't a part of it, and that sends you down a line of administration. So before I became a full professor, I became an associate professor and an associate dean. 3 years later, I went up for full. The day I became a full professor, I became senior associate dean and continued along that way until eventually I was dean of the, by the time I left, largest college of computing in the country. That matters because for me, and because of, you know, what my mother taught me when I was very young, it was important to think about both of these things at once. What does it mean to be a citizen in the university doing the kind of work that you're supposed to do, you get evaluated for, you get rewarded for? And what does it mean for the organization to be a citizen of the larger environment that it's in? And how do you play a role in doing both of those things if you can? And that sort of drove me there. Eventually, I left. I went to Wisconsin-Madison, which is 2 hours that way, 2.5 hours that way, roughly 7 degrees colder in the winter.
By snowmobile, it could be.
Yeah, yeah. Urbana-Champaign is 7 degrees warmer on average in the winter than it is in Madison. Not that I looked it up. And it was a wonderful place. And it was there that I first got exposed to what it meant to be a land grant, what it meant to be a fully comprehensive university. It was a transformative 2 years for me. And then I ended up here at Illinois. Which brings me to my second story about being a professor in Illinois. When I was young, a young assistant professor, shortly after they invented fire, I found myself coming up to Urbana-Champaign about 3 or 4 times a year. I was a part of this. I was doing machine learning. There was a group there that was trying to figure out how to model climate, and in particular, is a hurricane going to make landfall or not? Will it be Category 3? Will it be Category 5? And they needed a machine learning, AI guy, computing guy, to be a part of it, and I somehow got in it. And I would come up here 3 or 4 times a year, and it was an amazing experience for me. It was the place where I learned what it meant to do big interdisciplinary research at scale, and then, in fact, you couldn't do the big things that you might want to do, understand and predict things that would affect millions of people without working across disciplines, without taking advantage of a larger infrastructure. And that was transformative for me. I also learned not just the good parts about it, but the bad parts about it. That, you know, we spent 2 years both talking about probability before we figured out we were talking about two completely different things. I was right, by the way. I don't know what they were talking about. But it's okay. It's okay. At the end of the, no. You should ask yourself, what does it mean to have a 30% chance of rain? Like, what does that mean? It turns out it doesn't mean anything. But you have to sort of talk and sort of think it through. Don't get me started on that. Anyway, the point is that I...
For another program, we actually
for another
we had Tom Skilling in partnership with the university. We had Tom Skilling and Don Wobbles here talking about just that a few months ago. We'll do it again.
It's a meaningless... Anyway, okay, the point is that...
Moving right along.
It took us years to figure this out. And then when we did, we were able to do great things together. And so that taught me about the ability to do something wonderful with people with completely different experiences and perspectives, but also... you know, the difficulty you have to do to make that work. You should ask me about the difficulty of diverse groups at some point one day. And that sort of drove me through about the kind of work that I did, which is my way of answering your question. I'll wrap it up with this. That's the CV. That's the career path. 2 years at Wisconsin-Madison, was not expecting to leave for at least two or three more years. This opportunity arose. And because of both my experiences here and because of what I knew about this great university and what I knew about this great state, this great city, these great cities, I knew that I had to go for it. And why? Because I believe fundamentally, that we are in a period of significant chaos and change. I don't think I have to explain that to anyone in this room, but the world is, Rufus and I were having this conversation, you all have probably heard of this expression. How does it go? There are decades where nothing happens, and there are weeks where decades happen. And we are in one of those periods of time where decades are happening every week. Across higher ed, across the country, whether you're in Chicago, a couple of miles here or there, whether you're in Minnesota. Things are happening, and things are changing. We're in the middle of history. And I think that there are at most five, maybe six, universities that can lead the conversation about that will help us get from here to there. And those places need to be large. They need to be public. They need to be elite, not elitist. They need to be a part of their community. There needs to be history. They need a political environment that supports what they do. They don't, if they're spending all their time fighting with the legislature and the governor's office, it's hard to move. It's hard to be brave. It's hard to take risks. All of those things, they're in very few places, but they're here. And how can I pass up an opportunity to be at a great place, at a great time that can do great things? And so that's how I ended up here.
So here you are, and now you've led me down a couple different paths. You said a few things that just triggered. Here you are. You said big. The university is, as far as I understand, the biggest it's ever been.
Mm-hmm. 60,000
students. 60,000
students. 70% of whom from Illinois.
Great.
A quarter of whom are from Chicago and Chicagoland.
Okay. So I want to we got a number of paths to go down here. So 60,000, the university's doing pretty well. We'll also get into, there are cuts, there are difficult times. Mm-hmm. You've been there since August. What are you seeing? You came in at a great time. What are we going to see in a year from now that you really, now that you've got a lay of the land, what's number one? What's your major initiative going to be?
So I'm going to answer your question by giving you two answers, which is my way of cheating, but that's fine. First off, I think if you ask me, it's a big yes. What is it that we're going to see in a year and a half? Two different things. One, it's about listening and bringing the community and connecting with people. In order to affect the kind of change that a place like this can affect, you need to bring people in and you need to understand where they're coming from. They have to believe that there's a possibility there. So on my birthday, December 18th, happy birthday to me, we announced to the university and the larger community that we were launching a strategic plan. Now, a strategic planning effort. There are people in this room who are very happy to hear that, and there are a bunch of people in this room who like strategic plans, whatever. That's just the thing the new guy does, and there'll be this nice book, and it'll be on a shelf, and nobody will ever talk about it again. And maybe, but no. I think the point is not the thing. The point is the process. And the process is about getting people to come together, share language, share goals, and to do something that's very hard in higher education, which is to create a set of shared beliefs about what it is that we're going to do, and that we're going to have to get there, and that it's important, so that we can point to it when we need to move quickly. We agreed on this. This helps us do this in this environment. Therefore, we can do it. We don't need 17 committees. We can live with 16, and we can make it go. Having that conversation, bringing people in. That's a four-month conversation, by the way. We announced the committee, the steering committee. It will be done by April, May, and we will launch it formally in the fall.
And who are you listening to in that? And I'll let you continue, but who do you have it? Like, who are you hearing from as you create this plan for the future?
Staff, students, faculty, alum, community members, both locally in Champaign-Urbana, but across the state and our people everywhere.
Great. I was hoping you would say students. I figured you would. But I think that's a really important, as I mentioned, we have some young folks here. And we love doing that at City Club. They're some of the brightest and most interesting people who are willing to share new ideas. So anyway, very encouraged to hear that. And I'm glad that's something you're embarking on.
But you asked for one thing, and here's the second thing.
Yeah.
They're going to be pillars. By the way, this is a real... I want to emphasize that this is not just a framework that we're going to use and then people can point to. We're going to give ourselves real goals. We're going to give ourselves things that we're going to accomplish, and we're going to double down on those things and move them forward. But whatever the details are, whatever we come up with, I mean, you know what some of them are going to be. We care about education. We care about research. We care about discipline. I mean, we care about the community. You know this. The details will matter. But what I really hope will come out of this, and I hope it'll come out of the conversations not just with the people on campus, but the people outside the campus, goes back to what I said at the beginning about being able to affect and change the world. This is what I want for this university. This is sort of the vision, I think, that drives what we want to be able to do. The University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, will affect every important political, social, and technological decision in the world. Because we can, and because we should. And I think both of those things matter. The should matters, and the can matters. And this means that no one anywhere will do anything big without asking, well, what does Illinois think? What do those folks down in Champaign-Urbana think? What does Chicago think? What does Illinois think? Because our alum will be there, our students will be there, our staff will be there, our faculty will be there, our friends will be there, and we will help to drive that conversation. This is not coming from hubris, although in 5 years you might decide it is. It's coming from what I think is a fundamental fact about this place. The LED was invented. There are 25 Nobel Prizes from this. The internet, for good or ill, was driven out of work that was done here 30-something, actually at this point. 35 years ago. Jeez, I'm old. All that happened here, right? All that happened because of the larger ecosystem that we're a part of. That is an opportunity to go big. That is an opportunity to change, and it's a responsibility to do that.
Okay, again, you've got me in. Okay, so Chicago, let's go ecosystem Chicago and AI. I'm giving you a little preview.
Okay.
I love that you brought Chicago into it. Urbana, you know, Champaign's 130-some miles away from here.
It's an hour 45 to drive.
So why Chicago was so important? How is Chicago going to be integrated into this vision and into what's coming?
Well, I told you, a quarter of our undergrads come from here. There are 250,000 living alum here. And this is an amazing ecosystem. There's a whole set of cool people sitting out in front of us, listening to us right now.
Yeah.
Right? And they represent not just people here in this room, but people in the connections and the networks that they have, because Chicago is an important place. I mean, it's easy to forget this, but Chicago is the third largest metropolitan area, and it's the third largest city. You take a place like Atlanta, which I have nothing but positive things to say about, it's the sixth largest metropolitan area, but it's like the 31st largest city. Right? That's a completely different relationship between it and the state, relationship between it and the suburbs and all of, and the political, it's all very different. This is a place that has an ecosystem and a history, wonderful architecture, that can bring people together to do amazing things. There's a corridor from Champaign-Urbana to Chicago. There's a ripple that comes out of Chicago that touches the rest of Illinois. It would be ridiculous to not be a part of that ecosystem. The ridiculousness works both ways, by the way. It would be ridiculous for Chicago and the people in Chicago not to connect and take advantage of what's happening downstate and in the rest of Illinois. We have resources, we have people, we have talent, and we have history that connects us together through this corridor. So it's just not possible to do the kinds of things that we want to do, Urbana-Champaign, without partnerships with UIC, without partnerships with Springfield, without partnerships with government, without partnerships with industry, with startups, with the whole ecosystem has to be a part of it. It just can't be done alone, and it can't be done alone by anybody in that group. So, of course, you have to be here. And, of course, you have to figure out how to build those kind of connections together in a way that is non-zero-sum game.
So part of part of that existing partnership and growing, partnership between Chicago and the university is revolving around quantum.
Yes.
And AI. And, I mean, you told us a little bit about your history. It sounds to me like you're ahead of the game. You were, a computationalist.
That's right.
Before people were talking about AI, long before people were talking about AI. I'm not trying to age you.
You want to hear an interesting statistic?
Yeah.
So the 1980s were 40 years ago. Which is, I think, the worst sentence I've ever heard in my life.
I was born in that decade.
Yeah. You were born in the 80s?
Yeah.
Jesus. No. Am I allowed to do it? Do I need a chaperone up here?
So a lot's happened in those years. And now exponentially. I mean, talk about AI and how quickly things are happening. And can we tie AI and what in your history, your work, into what's going to happen in Chicago? I would love to see, and we've all talked about it here, Chicago and Illinois being the center of the, we are the center of the country, we are the best city and the best state in the country, but how about being the center of the world for AI and for these companies that are coming here, that startups, the people that are researching at your university, keep them in this area and make this the hub of AI. Is that something that you think could happen?
Yes.
Can you help lead us there?
Yes.
What do we need to do?
Yes. Here's the thing. Okay, so I do machine learning and AI. I'm a computationalist. We know all this. I can tell you something that people who do what I do understand. In order, as we were talking about before with an ecosystem, in order to do the kind of thing at the kind of scale you're talking about with something like quantum, you need investment and partnership from a whole set of people and folks. You just need that. Illinois has managed to do that investment, to bring people in and to create IQMP, to create the Chicago Quantum Exchange, all of these things to create an environment that puts it 5-10 years ahead of everyone else. When I talk to people in other parts of the country, they say, well, Illinois has the best chance of making this happen. And the reason Illinois has the best chance of making this happen is first mover advantage, but also it has it's in the middle of the country. It's got the right kind. I mean, it's not Silicon Valley, but there's an easy trip from here to there. You've got people, a lot of things that have come out of this. You've got venture capital. You've got a world-class university. In fact, your world-class universities. You've got all of these things in one place. Other people cannot invest quickly enough to build the infrastructure that already exists here. So it is ours to lose. And whoever gets there first, and it had better be us, will be able to hold this advantage for a decade. And that's all you need to be able to have all the knock-on effects that you want to have. And those knock-on effects won't just be on quantum. They'll be on all the things that tie together. You mentioned AI. AI is really important and central, although I don't think in the way that people tend to think about it. I think people actually think about AI in the wrong way. But you won't be able to do the AI you need to do in the future without something like quantum, and you won't be able to do quantum without AI. So you need both of these things together. That's why the Discovery Partners Institute is focusing on computing in Chicago. It's a place strategy as well that ties together what we're doing in Urbana-Champaign to here with all of the great ecosystem that is here to support both AI and quantum and a variety of other things. That is going to be necessary to move it forward. But, I mean, you guys should feel really good about this. I mean, we really are ahead of everybody else, and everyone else knows it. So long as we don't lose the momentum, we will win.
So, good. I'm referring to a couple... I had a whole plan for a conversation, and this is incredible. You are do you guys have an extra hour? Can we just...
Okay.
We've got some time. I'm going to refer, because I also like to incorporate some questions that people have submitted, because this is a conversation. Mm-hmm. But you're right. We have President Preckwinkle. We have government, Clerk Valencia. We have philanthropy. These are all partners in these investments and in these. We have Clayco here. They're building. They're designing. They're all over the country, but especially here in Chicago. And that's what we're about here, mm-hmm. is bringing all those folks together. So it's great to hear that from you and to hear some great encouragement for what's to come, because there is an awful lot to come. So thank you for that. Sticking with AI for a minute, because we do have a couple of members who had more specific questions, and they're smarter than I am. So Walter Johnson asked an interesting one about about AI in particular. In China, there's no expectation of data privacy. Thus, training data is more plentiful. Is AI so critical that it's worth sidestepping our usual American values around privacy and ownership in order to win the AI race? And now I'm getting real specific, but it's in line, I think, with what you're talking about.
So first off, I appreciate the softball question. I think...
We got another hour.
Here's the most straightforward way to answer this. There's two parts, and I'll just leave it at that, and then we can follow up if you want. The answer is no, it is not worth it. And the answer is it doesn't matter anyway because we give up all of our data for free. Every single one of you, Tim Cook knows where every single one of you is. Elon Musk knows where probably a third of you are. All of this, we're doing this constantly. So my work, machine learning and AI, is specifically in modeling human behavior. It's in modeling it, it's in predicting it, and then it's figuring out how to intervene to affect the behavior that folks do. Now, you can imagine good uses for this. Make certain that your type 2 diabetes gets actually monitored and dealt with and affect and push you in one direction or another. And you can imagine bad ways this might get used. One of the things that I learned many years ago early on in my life is not only are we all willing to give up our data, myself included, but it takes nothing to figure out what you do for a living. You eat the same food, you go to the same restaurants, you do the same thing over and over again. And of course you do, because there's no other way to deal with the world. If every single moment of the world is completely novel and new, it kind of is, but if it doesn't have underlying structure, then you can't operate, right? So you are easy to figure out. So I've learned two things about people. One, they're incredibly easy to predict, and they hate it when you tell them they're incredibly easy to predict. So what happens here is that we don't have to overcome those. What we have to do, because we're giving up the data that's going to allow us to build the models we care about anyway. This is why ChatGPT and LLMs actually work so well, because all the information is out there. Here's the right question to ask about this. What, given that we are giving up all of our data voluntarily, what is it that we need to do to make certain that that data gets used responsibly? And how do we make certain that people are held accountable for the way that gets done? So the answer to the first question is we treat it as a real responsibility. We don't talk about ethical AI, which is fine, you can. You talk about responsible computing. You talk about responsible AI. The difference between AI and computing, there is no difference. All AI is really is computing, but with more data and stuff that's around people and compute. That's not a small thing, but that's really what's driving it. It's what's giving us power. This revolution started once computers became democratized, right? Once they sort of got out in the world. That was inevitably going to lead to something like AI. But there's a legal... regulatory framework, a sort of fundamental question, not of telling companies you can't do this or telling what, or that you have a right to be forgotten. It's that things must be inspectable. It must be the case that the systems that are built can be understood for what they are, and you can understand how the answers they have, where they came from, and why. And that's not about being able to look at everyone's data and know what's going on. Interesting technical work there, but that's not what it is. It's not about preventing people from sharing their data. It's about being able to understand why a particular thing happened. And that's a technical and a legal and a political problem that if you bring it together makes the question... less important than it seems on its face, because it's how you deal with this that is really, really going to matter for the future.
I'm hearing a lot from, I was taking your advice, listen. Again, I'm instead of just asking questions, I'm trying to listen. I'm hearing in between some of your sentences, there's from a computationalist, am I saying that?
Yes, sure.
Who knows the technology, who knows the data, who knows the overwhelming ability of it all. There's such a human element here that you can't lose, right? Is that safe to say that no matter what AI can do, there's always going to be that human?
Yeah. It's the only reason it's important. It's the only reason it actually matters. I mean, if you think about the technological revolutions that matter the most to people, they fall into two categories. They either fall in the category of health, ultimately, or they fall into a category of communication that connects people together. Right, so yes, the humans. So I'm going to say something technical for a moment. So computing is its own discipline. It is not engineering. Sorry, Rashid. It is not engineering. It is not the humanities. It is not science. Although it has pieces of those things. fundamentally, what disciplines give you is the ability to see the world differently from other disciplines. So if you're a mathematician, a result is a theorem, right? It's about abstract truth that is static and lives forever. If you're a philosopher, it's an argument, right? It's a way to talk about something in precise language. Engineers provide for us fundamental notions around trade-offs. Demonstrably superior technology, according to an object, right? What is computing? Computing understands fundamentally that models, languages, and machines are important, and they're equivalent. That we can build a thing that actually represents the world, and it is self-aware, self-reflecting, and can be executed. We didn't have a language for that 100 years ago, 150 years ago. We do now. That's what computing brought into our world. That triangle, that thing, models, languages, machines are equivalent, has been around now for 100 years. And then people got in the middle of the triangle. The data, what makes this important is that the information allows this triangle to predict and affect and do things. And that only matters because it's about people. It's about us. So responsibility around that comes from fundamentally centering people and the impact on people in what you do. Can I mention Amara's law?
Yes.
Okay. How many of you have heard of Amara's law? How many of you have been to a place where I've mentioned Amara's law before? Okay. So Amara's law is my third favorite law. And it states, quite simply, that... It states quite simply that... We overestimate the short-term impact of technology and we underestimate the long-term impact. This is not the hype cycle where, you know, you put too much in and everyone goes crazy and then there's a bubble. It's not that. Amara is about what we believe and what we expect and how we predict technology. It's going to change the world tomorrow without thinking about how it's going to change the world. So let's go back again to the example I gave about the modern day internet, which of course came out of Urbana-Champaign.
Humble brag.
Humility is about knowing your strengths and your weaknesses. And yes, that was a humble brag. So go back to 1991, 1992, 1993, and read what people were saying. Listen to what they were saying. This new World Wide Web, the internet had been around for 30 years at that point easily. What did it do? Like, what were people thinking it was going to do? Oh, it's going to change everything. By 1995, the world's going to be a completely different place. FTP is going to change the way that we do science. You don't even know what that is, right? But it mattered at the time. That didn't really happen. Not really. But 25 years later, we have social media. We have an epidemic of loneliness that affects not just teenagers in the way that they see themselves, but it affects people in their 50s and 60s. It drives a huge epidemic of loneliness among men as they enter past middle age. We know that it's completely changed the outcome of multiple elections around the world. It drives what we do. It gives people the ability to think that everyone thinks what they think because you create a bubble that gives you an illusion that there are millions of people who believe what you believe because you can do those connections. It drives everything to sameness while at the same time separating us from one another where we have this kind of illusion. That's 25 years ago. Right? Like the world's, I don't think we appreciate this, those of us who were born before the 1980s, and have lived through this, that the world is completely different from what it was in 1975. It's not even remotely the same, other than human beings are in it, and they're still doing what human being thinks, right? Completely different. To me, AI, quantum, all these things that we're talking about, that's the fundamental question. Not what is quantum going to do either for us economically or with workforce or is going to change the way that my business runs in the next 3 months. Not what is AI going to do. These are important questions. But how is the world going to look radically different in 2045 because we're doing these things now? What does that mean? And then what is our responsibility for dealing with it? So we want to drive it forward. We want to shape it, yes. And we also need to make certain that we both educate the 18-year-olds coming to college now, the 25-year-olds going to college now, the people who are going to have to come back to be trained and educated, make certain that our politicians understand how this works enough, that our judiciary understands enough to be able to make this. Like, we have to find a way to bring everyone into that so that we don't wake up one day and the world has changed in a way that we do not want it to be. You know, remember, in the great utopia in the future, nobody works. And in the great dystopia of the future, nobody works. Right? We can end up with the same outcome in many ways. And in one way, it's great, or it can be awful. And if we aren't planning for that now, it'll just be a surprise which one it is. So I think that when we think about all these questions, everything that we're sort of talking about is just kind of underlying all of them. It's really about the future and what we have to do to prepare ourselves for it, and how we collectively are going to drive that in a direction that is slightly better. That's a metaphor analogy I like to use a lot, is that we're talking about an aircraft carrier, and all we want to do is move that aircraft carrier from here to here. That's it. Which doesn't seem like much, but it's the difference between ending up over there and ending up over there. Right? And so these small decisions that we make, these small structural decisions that we make about the way that we organize ourselves, the way that we interact with one another, they're going to have these huge outsized impacts 20, 25 years from now. And we need to ask ourselves what 20, 25 years look like so we can make certain we make the... I learned that, by the way, from the meteorologist when I came here. That's what the chaos equations tell you. Small changes in the beginning lead to huge changes in the end.
You heard it here. Are you, seriously, are you still teaching?
No, it's the saddest thing about the job that I did. Up until, even when I was dean, I was teaching about 3,300 students a year. I taught my last class in 2023. It's the worst
thing. I would reconsider that. I don't know who needs to approve this, but I would go back to school. I don't know how you guys felt, but that was pretty... pretty amazing, and inspiring and just fascinating. So thank you for taking us down that. We have a few minutes. We have a lot that I'd love to get to. On the human side, let's talk for a minute about access to education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, so much zip code determines this and that. There are brilliant people in places that cannot afford to go to a university of the stature of U of I. Or is that not the case? And I actually have one specific question that Tim Thomas, an alumni and varsity alumni here, I'm going to get to this in a minute. I have another question specifically about... I'm just hung up on all this amazing. What investment? This came from Sheila Caldwell. What investments or new programs are you planning to remove barriers such as academic, financial, or cultural for gifted low-income students from Chicago to enroll, persist, and graduate?
Yeah, you know, so there's at least five parts there. So
yeah. In 5 minutes.
Oh, well, I can do that. As you can tell, I am very brief in my answers. Okay, let's start with the basic problem. The basic problem is we're not reaching out to people and making it clear to them that this is a possibility. Before you even get to money, before you even get to the rest of it, right? Again, 8 miles away, 800 miles away. We had years where no one from the Atlanta Public School System even applied to Georgia Tech. Years. No one applied CS for like 3 or 4 years. We changed that in very simple ways, and it changed everything about the way the people who came. So that's the first thing. It needs to be clear to them that we care. We need to connect with them. We have programs like this. My fellow chancellors have programs like this to sort of bring people. We're not doing enough of it. We need to do more of it. So that matters before you even get to the details of the rest of the question. Then once they're there, okay, so first off, once they realize it's a possibility and you care, then you have to make it affordable. That first part's accessibility, by the way. The second part is affordability. So we have the Illinois commitment for Illinois students so that they don't have to pay tuition and fees. About half of them pay less than $3,000 a semester because of this. Half of them live without debt. There's all of these things that we do that are programmatic, and you have to make that possible. It's Illinois Commitment for us, and Illinois Promise for us, and it's got different names at the other two universities. But we all do things like this, and that's important. But then there's also this third thing, which is making sure that people, once they're there, aren't just surviving, but they're thriving. I'll give you a very short story about this. So at one of my previous institutions, the president decided that the right thing to do was to make it possible for every salutatorian and valedictorian to come to the university. It was remarkably controversial at the time, but he pushed it through. It was amazing from the Atlanta Public School System, and then later it became the state of Georgia, which means I've just told you where it is. But anyway, that all happened and went really well. First year we did this, you know, you go from nobody applying to a bunch of people applying, not just the valedictorians and the salutatorians. So they come, they get accepted. And I was talking to a good friend of mine, a guy named Cedric Stallworth, who was an associate dean of mine. He used to play football. He was a wonderful guy. He he and I were having a conversation about this, and I said, well, how many of them are in the challenge program? What's the challenge program? It's a thing that happens in the summer before your first semester. Why? Because we know for a fact that that first semester matters more than anything. And if you can get people to have a good first semester, it drives so much more success. So we brought people in the half of the summer before, and they go, on, it's all great. Answer was none of them. None of them had applied. Why not? So we reached out, he reached out, and he talked to them, and the answer was, well, it's like $700, because they had to pay for help.
Just to apply.
Well, not to apply, to do the thing. The application part's easy. It's that once you got in, you didn't have to pay for school or whatever, but you had to pay for housing because, you know, housing had to stand on its own. And it was $700. And I can't spend $700. I need to go, you know, work for the summer so that I can afford to be in school next semester. And that was crazy. Like, none of them. And it didn't occur to anyone to ask the question. So he asked me, and I approved. We would just fund it for everybody. So that's $70,000 for us, which was in the statistical noise, but $700 for them was the difference between coming or not coming. And they came. And by the way, all the ones who came were successful, and a whole bunch of them switched majors. So it was win-win-win-win-win-win-win-win, right? But that's a simple thing, right? It's not enough to do the first thing, make it accessible, even make it affordable. You have to do the follow-on to make certain that people are successful by asking questions. It just didn't occur to anybody to ask the question. It was actually very lucky that Cedric ran this program and saw this, and he cared. He was also a product of the Atlanta Public School System like I was. And so he knew these people. He knew the teachers. He knew the students. And we were able to solve it with not a lot of effort, but it had a huge impact on these kids. And then once it was proved to be successful, that made it easier for the next cohort, the next cohort, the next cohort, and it's still working to this day.
Well, thank you for asking those questions and following up on them. I have so many. We can't leave here without at least talking for a minute about sports.
Oh, sure.
I mean, we've got a couple experts in the room, right? What are we going to see in the next year? What should we keep an eye out for? What's how are things coming? I think the men's basketball, women's basketball, both doing pretty well.
Yeah.
What do you got your eye on?
Winning.
Winning?
I would like to win. We're doing really well. You know, it's interesting. Before, when I was earlier in my life, I was actually the faculty athletic representative for sports at my university. I was the NCAA rep. So I got really into this early, not as a fan. I mean, I love sports. I play racquetball. I play racquetball and I come to Chicago and I'm looking for partners. And Ultimate Frisbee, I take it very seriously. I've been to nationals. I'd love to be a part of it. I do care about sports. But I wasn't that for actually as a fan. The president of the university at the time decided that he wanted all of his faculty athletic representatives not just to be fans, but people who might actually care about the university and understand what role Division I, in this case, sports plays in it. And it worked, by the way. His first FAR, Chancellor at UC Davis, his second one, president of Rice. One of them's Chancellor at the University of Illinois. It's great. And the reason that worked that way is because it really helps you to understand the complexities of a large university with people from a variety of places where you actually do care about sports, you care about excellence in research, you care about teaching, you care about all of these things, and how much they touch one another. And it teaches you a lot about what can go right and what can go wrong in a place that from afar looks pretty simple. So what I care about, this will circle back to something in the beginning around leadership, is I think, and I don't think it's obvious to a lot of people, but this university has actually been in the forefront of leading the conversations around what we're doing with NIL, what we're doing with sports, what is the future of collegiate sports. Josh, our athletic director, he's testified before Congress on these issues. He is today, I think, or maybe tomorrow, he's off in D.C. because he's a representative for the NCAA in thinking about these issues. We are actually leaders in the national conversation around athletics and how do you maintain student and athlete, not student or athlete. We're leading that conversation because people like him. And I don't think that everyone appreciates that because I think it's mostly invisible. But I think what you're going to see, besides all the change and the tumult that comes from what we're going to be doing over the next year or two with NIL and the like, but you're also going to see some positive changes. And I can all but guarantee that a lot of those will be because of people at this university who are helping to lead those conversations. And so I don't want that to go by. Like, I don't want people to not realize that, you know, the right person in the right place who's willing to take a risk and to think carefully about something can actually affect change in a positive way. And so that's what I think you're actually going to see. You're not going to see it. You're going to read it in The Athletic or wherever it is that you follow your sports. And by the way, along the way, we're going to win our bowl game next year as well. And we're going to stay ranked and we're going to keep doing all these amazing things. And those things go together. Excellence goes together with leadership, right? It's all a part of it. It's no different from the conversation we've been having around AI or quantum. It's no different about excellence with entrepreneurship, changing the mindset around that. It's all of a piece. And what I love about this place is excellence. We recognize that excellence has to be everywhere.
Another masterclass. We'll wrap up here. You talk a lot about leadership. You talked about, you know, someone being in the right place at the right time and affecting change. There's someone else in this room that we mentioned earlier. And I think it was news this morning that President Killeen is going to be stepping down after over 10 years as the president of the system. We have been, as I mentioned, very fortunate to have him grace this stage a number of times, and we hope to do that again soon. But I'd like to ask how that might affect that change in leadership and all that he has done to bring the university system to where it is today. Thank you for all that effort, first of all, President Killeen. Thank you. And you know, great that you've got some footing now and can help kind of steer this ship right in the right direction. How might that leadership change affect what's going on with the university?
So first off, it's important to understand that none of us are fungible, whether we're irreplaceable or not. None of us are fungible. The world is a different place because you were in the room, you were in the room, you were in the room, or I was in the room, Tim was in the room. Like, it matters who's in the room. What I think we can say, and I think we can all agree, is that the system has put collectively, through leadership and otherwise, has created an environment where excellence can thrive and where success can happen. And 18 months or so is a pretty long time. There's lots of opportunity for us to continue working on this. And so on the one hand, it changes everything because the world will be different. We'll be thinking differently about this. We'll be trying to use this as an opportunity to figure out what we can do next. And on the other hand, nothing's going to change because we're going to continue to work together. We're going to continue to move everything forward. I suspect there's nothing that I've said up here that Tim would disagree with. Certainly not publicly. Isn't that correct, Tim? Right? So he is going to continue to live up to his notion of excellence. And by the way, that'll be true for the chair of the board. That'll be true for the other two chancellors who are sitting at my table. And I know it'll be true for everyone in this room. So we're going to continue to work together. We're going to continue to move things forward. He and I had a conversation yesterday. There's a lot of great things to do, and so we are going to do them. Right? And I think that will be true, and I look forward to having those conversations and making that difference with Tim and all my colleagues, including my 100 or so best new friends that I've met here this afternoon.
Who are all very much committed to continuing to move this state, this city forward.
Absolutely.
You know, I started by mentioning who is here because that's important, but I also started by asking, will you come back? And I think I'll end with that as well, because there's so much to learn. There's so much for all of us to learn from you. It's refreshing to hear all that you're sharing with us. Leadership is especially these days, it's monumentally important to have good leaders. We're blessed to have so many of them come and grace this stage. Oh, this has been an incredible day.
Thank you.
An honor for me again to sit and chat with you. Thank you for your leadership.
I appreciate it.
Thank you for your commitment to coming back.
Yes, I will be back.
And thank you for all that you're doing for the state of Illinois.
So may I say one thing?
Of course.
To wrap this up. So first off, thank you so much for inviting me here. I've appreciated this conversation and the conversations that I was able to have before sitting down and eating. I really appreciate the food. That was really good. And all that. I'm going to leave you with this. Someone asked me a question about motivating me, and this was your first question. So I just want to leave it here, and then we can talk about this later. When I wake up in the morning, the question I ask myself is, how can we be good ancestors? How can we, I mean, this is a place that's been around 158 years. 158 years from now, people are going to be looking back. And we want them to say that whatever the craziest was that was happening at the time, we've made the best decisions we could, we invested in it, we took appropriate risks, and as a result, they're in a better place than they would have been otherwise. Alma mater on this campus talks about the past saying hello to the present. And I think that's the same. That's consistent with what we all care about and what we're trying to do. The whole point of the exercise is impact, right? That's why we're here. That's how immortality happens, is because you affect your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, right? So I just want to say that I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you all, and I'm very much looking forward to the next 7, 8, 9, 10, 20 years working with you in helping the city, helping the state, helping the universities to do well, because I believe that we all want to be good ancestors. Thank you.
Let's end it there. I think there's so many people that would agree and look to you in many years and say that you helped them get to where they are. So thank you again. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for coming back. We're going to, there are QR codes. We have a lot of programs coming up. I can't promise. Well, they're going to be good. They're going to be good. This was incredible. Thanks again. You guys all have a great rest of your week.